Good morning, creators. Welcome to the 80th episode of the Media 1099 podcast. My name is Michael Durr, and I'm here with my co-host Robert Husky, talking freelance and art in 2020. Season 3 continues to roll on, and we just wrapped with Matthew Baker, money strategist and VP of corporate strategy at FreshBooks. Robert, what was this interview like for you?
Mike, this was like a great interview for me, very enlightening. Some quick little key points of information, you know, like, hey, you should be using 20% of your time to prospect. And is that finding new, you know, new clients, potential clients, marketing? Like, what does that entail? Also kind of thinking about what income you think you're going to have versus what's actually coming in. I thought that was another very insightful little tidbit.
Yeah, I think that anytime you have a chance to talk to somebody, even if they're not necessarily niched down in the sense of like he's a CPA or he's a, you know, advisor for investments, you know, we talked a lot about generalities in this episode that I think people are going to listen to, but it really gives you a great big picture concept of what to look for, how to manage your money. The whole concept of this conversation was how to de-risk the move into self-employment. So maybe you are self-employed and just doing it part-time, or you are doing it full-time and you just need some refreshers on how to use your money, how to manage it, how to spend it. And it's not a one-size-fits-all solution for everybody, but I think it's just interesting to talk to somebody that has some insight, how to coach that. And I really came away with a lot of different things. Like you said, that 20% prospecting, I think they're all really great ideas and concepts. Do you have anything else that you'd like to tease about this to the audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a great opportunity for us to talk to a business and money strategist. You know, I think we don't get to encounter those every day. So it was great having his time and him, you know, talking with us and also like just enjoying the fluid conversation that was going on.
Right. So we hope you guys enjoy the episode. We got a quick sponsor ad, and Media 1099 with Matt Baker is coming up next. Okay, welcome back, Media 1099 listeners. Thank you guys so much for spending a little time with us today, wherever you're listening from. I hope you're excited to gain a little knowledge, a little insight, and maybe a little inspiration on how to be a better creative professional. We have a great episode today, and I'm really excited to share this with you. For everyone who's a side hustler out there, for all of you moonlighting as a creative freelancer on top of your 9-to-5, if you're thinking about taking that plunge and making it a full-time career, we really hope you tune into this episode. And I'm going to tell you something. Anyone who's pushed all their chips in on self-employment can really attest to the challenges that come with that move. I know firsthand. There can be financial hurdles. There can be relationship hurdles. There can even be existential questions about your purpose in life simply as a result of just one bump in the road. But I don't believe there's anything more effective at sharpening your business acumen than going into business on your own. And to this day, it has been the most empowering and fulfilling decision of my professional life. So I can really speak from experience that this is worth it. Now, I pulled up a quick stat this morning. About 35% of the country is actively freelancing in some capacity, the highest percentage of which are creatives just like you, myself, Robert. It's going to be a great opportunity to ask ourselves today, what are the actual risks? What mindsets are needed to transition from employee to freelancer, from freelancer to entrepreneur? And most importantly, what business strategies, what philosophies, what tactics will help safeguard that move to full-time self-employment? That's what we're going to be asking today. That's where our esteemed guest, Matthew Baker, comes into play. He's going to help us de-risk that harrowing plunge into self-employment and deconstruct some of the best financial habits of successful business owners. So if that sounds interesting to you, please don't go anywhere. Matthew Baker holds many titles, including financial strategist, business coach, and senior VP of corporate development and international expansion at FreshBooks Accounting. Just a little side plug, FreshBooks is the accounting software that I use, and I'm really not saying this just because he's here on the show, but that has been one of the best investments I've made in 5 years as a freelancer. It has transitioned from going manually creating estimates and invoices to near automating them, and my stress level and my workload has lessened so much, and has really served my clients in a significantly more professional manner and certainly faster. So for Robert and myself, I think we're just lucky to have Matt here as our very own business consultant for the next hour. So let's just jump right into it. Making his debut on the Media 1099 podcast, Matthew Baker, welcome to the show, man, and thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thanks for the intro and looking forward to it.
Hey, Matt, thanks again for being with us. With so many young entrepreneurs entering the workforce, either currently or maybe in 2 to 5 years, what are a few blind spots that they might not see making this jump?
Got it. Okay, great question to start with. I think the thing that comes to my mind immediately, and the reason it does is it's because it has a sort of a visual element to it. And when I think about the finances of being self-employed, I think about it as being lumpy. And it's this feeling that it's up and down and it's not as consistent as a traditional job. In a traditional world, you have an employer to rely on that they're going to pay you every 2 weeks or, you know, every, you know, twice a month. However, you know, that's arranged and they take care of a bunch of stuff for you. They make sure that, you know, you pay taxes. They, if you sign up in advance, they help you with benefits. They'll also, you know, as a part of that, help not just with like retirement benefits, but healthcare and things like that. So there's just a lot going on when you get a regular job. And in a lot of ways, you know, the organizations are forced to help you through that. And then once you start working on your own, the biggest thing when I say lumpy is, you know, you could have a great month, but really that's got to last you 2 months because the next month maybe you're not going to have so good. And then, you know, and then it kind of goes up and down. And so there's this feeling of understanding how to think about it beyond just, you know, 1 week or 1 month at a time and think about how to smooth it out. And really that lumpiness is just, it's not the stability that we often think of when we're thinking about income, because, you know, everything from car payments to, you know, your Netflix subscription to, you know, your mortgage or your house payment, whatever, all of that's very consistent. And so all of a sudden you introduce this inconsistent income and it can really throw people, you know, for a loop, and it takes time to understand it and plan for it.
Yeah.
Beyond the financial aspect of not knowing when your clients are coming and then kind of holding a lot of hats, what else is it mentally? I think a lot of this comes down to mindset, at least personally, in terms of going into self-employment and doing this on your own. Can you elaborate on what you feel and what you've seen through your coaching or your experience of what that transition is like beyond just the financial numbers?
One of the things we did at FreshBooks is we surveyed several thousand self-employed professionals, freelancers, however you want to, you know, group that together. And we served them on what are some of the barriers. And we wanted to understand, you know, hard barriers like, you know, something, like capital. And then soft barriers too, which is some of the psychological things. And some of the stuff that came up to the top, you know, certainly number one was just, you know, the cash needed to do your own business. And so sometimes that can be startup money, depending on what type of business you want to get going. But also times it can just be savings, because, you know, as you try to make a switch, you may have a couple months there while you're building out your book of business that, you know, are a little softer. So you just need the savings to live on while you kind of start the next journey in your career. But if I put cash to the side for a moment, some of those other barriers that, you know, people, you know, certainly worry about. I mentioned one already, which was health benefits. That comes up a lot.
Right.
Another one would just be this feeling about, do I have a complete business plan? And I think some of that struggles with this idea of a business plan, you know, can mean so much and at the same time so little. It's just not a very, you know, well-defined phrase in our language, so to speak. You know, I've seen business plans that fit on one page and I've seen business plans that are 100 pages, right? So this idea of like, do I have, you know, it's just hard to, you know, gain that confidence sometimes. And that's why it's a little bit more psychological. But certainly, you know, some level of planning is just about going into any opportunity eyes wide open, so to speak.
I'm curious too, found that it's just difficult for people to not have the mentorship. There's not a lot of preparation. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this, but are schools offering courses in entrepreneurship and being self-employed? Because I would imagine it's a different skill set. I know it has been for me, and nobody was there to kind of guide me along that path. What's your experience with that?
Well, one thing that, you know, that I've done through a lot of conversations, and so this is going to be a little bit more anecdotal than fact-based, but mm-hmm. what I've found is that most people, the majority, let's say, of people who found a way to do it have had a strong mentor. And it's oftentimes someone that was, you know, part of their family when they were growing up. Maybe they had a parent that was an entrepreneur, or, you know, an uncle or an aunt, or, you know, somebody that was close to the family. And one way that you have to almost see it to understand it, because it's something that you really don't get training for. And to just go out there and do it on your own without a mentor, I think is just, you know, you're just setting yourself as a disadvantage to to others. And so I have seen certainly you've seen it somewhere, or you find somebody who can act as that mentor. And I think it makes a big difference, because all of a sudden, you know, that whole business is really on your shoulders, and you got to figure out the right way of what are you going to focus on? What are you going to, you know, hire somebody else to do for you, and how are you going to grow the business? And, you know, it's just, there's a lot of ups and downs, and that sort of, by the way, that's another way of just de-risking the move, is just being aware that, hey, there's going to be a lot of ups and downs. I need somebody to confide in, you know, whether that's a mentor, or there's just some time that you set aside to be able to focus on sort of self health, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But just going in and recognizing that, maybe one way I could put a finer point on this, when I speak to a lot of people who are self-employed, there's really not a bright demarcation between business and personal. It gets very intermingled, much more than most people find with an employer. You know, you can distance yourself from an employer. It's like, that's my job. That's my boss. That's the people who pay me. But then I have my family time. Once you become self-employed, those lines get blurry, and it doesn't have to be a bad thing, but then all of a sudden, you know, personal growth is business growth is personal growth, and all these things, you know, it just overlaps so much, and just understanding that is part of, you know, the journey as well. And so anyhow, it's just fascinating, because the other thing that we tend to see is that people who succeed with self-employment, they wouldn't want it any other way. You know, they have no interest in going back to a traditional job if you can make it work. And so, you know, I find that inspiring, but also just trying to unpack, well, what are some of the things that people can do to effectively de-risk it?
Yeah, that's illuminating to me. And I actually read this article that you wrote, and you once said that making the transition to full-time self-employment, you're unlikely to go back. Can you elaborate on what the data is telling you from these kind of journals that you're researching through FreshBooks? What are people telling you for the reason why they're not going back?
Okay, great way to enter into that space a bit. Firstly, on that fact is we've done the same type of study for 3 years now, going out to, you know, thousands of these folks and asking certain repetitive questions. And so one of the things we've seen over the full 3 years of that study is this question around, if you are in fact in the group that is self-employed, are you interested in going back to a traditional job? And that's the one where over 90% every year, you know, indicate I have no interest in doing so. And then so certainly at that point, it's like, wow, that's almost all, you know, about as close as you can get sometimes with survey results. And then so the question is why? And the way that I would connect those in my mind is understanding, not necessarily like, why don't you want a job, why wouldn't you be interested in going back, but what do you love about being self-employed? And the thing that always comes to the top is this concept of control. And it's, again, another sort of fascinating element for me, because I feel like sometimes we actually have more control in our traditional jobs than we realize. But this idea of switching to self-employment is so freeing that ultimately, you know, you know that you can embrace the control. And so just some of the examples that come to mind is this, you know, this idea of like, when to work. You know, maybe I want to take off Friday and I'll work on Saturday instead. When you're self-employed, you know, that's your call. You can do it. Lots of employers might allow you to do it, but you feel a little bit hemmed in. So that's just, you know, it's just harder to get into that mind space. Or another example would be which projects you work on. When you're self-employed, you know, you can hire, fire clients. You can decide what you're going to do, what you're not. I mean, it's your business that's going to, you know, either benefit or suffer as a result of that, but you're in control, so to speak. And I think, you know, oftentimes in jobs, you know, your boss may say you got to do this thing, but a lot of times people have control over the types of projects they work on, or they have more control than they realize is maybe what I'm trying to underscore there. But once you make the flip, you know, it's just, I am now, I get to decide what, you know, how I'm going to price things, how hard I'm going to work, when I'm going to work, where I'm going to work, who I'm going to work with. Like all of a sudden, you know, you're in the driver's seat, and that's a very, empowering, you know, feeling. And we find that, you know, ultimately is why you'd never go back. Cause then, you fall back into, I gotta be in the office 9 to 5. I gotta go to these meetings. My boss is on my back for this, you know? So anyhow, that's sort of the takeaway on that one.
So speaking of kind of that hemming in, like being a freelancer, like your life could be a little bit more sporadic because you are working those Saturdays and Sundays and maybe having like Tuesdays off. I know you have 7 financial habits that make a successful small business or entrepreneurs. What are maybe one or two of those key ones that could help with that sporadicness of entering the freelance workforce?
Well, a great question. In fact, financially, you know, that's it's hard to draw the link on that lifestyle work choice. But certainly I would say one of the things to understand maybe at the outset is just a way that you can regularly review your finances as a self-employed person, mm-hmm. a way that you can regularly, but separate it so you understand how your business is. Cause I think that's sometimes what people, you know, the next step would be to look at, okay, if my goal for myself is I want to make, you know, six figures a year, what you can start to do is just break it down to understand, okay, well, if I, you know, how many clients do I need given what I think each client's going to pay me per month to even get to that number? And you just kind of work back effectively, you know, the effort that's going to take or the scale of your business that's required. I think some of those efforts can help you understand whether you got to pull the weekend work or not. Because I think one of the concerns might be if I switch to self-employment, maybe I'm just going to work 80 hours a week because I just got to, you know, I got to do all this stuff. And I don't think that's the case. Some people work more, but certainly lots of people actually work less once they become self-employed because, they just work as much as they feel like they need to, so to speak. So in my mind, one of the tips there on the financials would just be, sort of having a way that you can regularly review your finances so that you know if you're on track or not. And I guess the part about being on track is having some kind of budget. And that's really to understand, you know, I got to double down and work harder if in order for me to meet my goals, if I need to have, let's call it half a dozen clients at any time, then you know that that's what, you know, what's going to trigger whether or not. So you'll know you need to put the time in on the weekend if you've dropped down to four clients and you want to build up, you know, your base and, you know, those types of things. So maybe that's how I'd connect the two.
Awesome. Staying on that, when you're talking about managing your money and reviewing your money, I think one of the hardest things that I've had to deal with is just kind of navigating what is personal expense money and what is professional expense money, and how you navigate this kind of intermingled mesh of, well, all of the money is coming from one spot. What are ways that you would suggest people that are freelancing, that are starting their own side hustle and turning it into their business? How do they measure that? How do they review that so that it's systematic, so that it makes sense, so that it's not convoluting everything?
Yeah, In fact, I love this space. I think there's a lot of opportunity here, and some of the stuff is pretty simple in terms of some quick tips. So it's a great opportunity to talk about a few of these things. So the first one would be just splitting up bank accounts. You know, creating a separate bank account for personal and business. That's one of the simplest things to do, and frankly, it's just one of those things that sometimes someone doesn't do until they get in trouble because, you know, it starts with, you know, this thing on the side is pretty small. So I don't need a separate bank account for this small thing. And then it gets a little bigger. And then all of a sudden, you know, it gets a little overwhelming. And it's just one of those things where, you know, there's got to be a breaking point. But at some point, if you just start splitting them, you know, certainly that's one tip that is super helpful. Another tip is once you become self-employed, all that income you receive is going to be taxed and nobody's taking it out for you in advance. So you almost have to again, create a separate place. You know, it could be a savings account versus a checking account or what have you, but create a separate place where almost every time you make money, you take 30% of it and just put it away. And you just assume have the mindset that that's the government's money. It's not mine. That's a really, really important tip because sometimes when people overspend, then tax time comes and they have to take out a loan or some type of access to capital just to pay down, you know, taxes. And that's a real cycle that you want to avoid as much as possible. So just not even thinking that it's yours. And by the way, that's one of those, you know, benefits of sometimes or one of the things that's made easier with a traditional job is that your employer often does that for you. So mm-hmm. anyhow, once you're self-employed, you got to, you know, keep that in mind. And then maybe the other one would be some kind of way to pay yourself, whether, you know, that's splitting up the personal and business into two accounts or you know, either way, you got to do it. So in that personal account, you could move money into that account from the business one at the end of each month that represents your take, so to speak. Or, you know, if you've got a, you know, I've seen it also where people would have like a business account and sort of pay everything out of that. And then whatever's left over is kind of their take. It doesn't really matter, I guess, if you're kind of building up or pulling out. The point would be having some way that you can see in your account what your profits are, so to speak, and then you can start to treat that money differently, because that's what your business is earning, as opposed to just, you know, the sort of working capital you need to run your business.
Yeah, I think a lot of, especially myself, like I struggled with that, is trying to move money from my working capital account into like my personal like income account. And I think a lot of that is, I have this mentality of like, I want to save for potential big investments, small investments, emergency funds for my business, instead of, you know, I like to see that number go up instead of maybe investing that in myself or in my business. For you, how would you say like starting that transition, besides maybe bank accounts, but like looking at return on investments for your business, you know, is it worth spending this $500 or $5,000 here if I could get X amount in?
Well, that's a great question. I think that's maybe, you know, also what you were introducing earlier, is that sometimes there's no training for this. You know, particularly if you mentioned a lot of creative professionals, I mean, all the training that you're doing is on your craft, and you're really trying to improve, you know, whether it's, you know, design or, you know, photography and you know, various, you know, sub verticals within there. You know, you're training on that, and that's what you kind of care about. And so this idea of like, oh, now I'm going to get into this, all this fancy ROI stuff, you know, can be really, really off putting. And so, certainly if you have some software that helps, you know, do some of that for you, that's helpful. I mean, obviously lots of people do stuff in Excel just cause it's kind of so accessible and easy, but at the same time, it takes time and you know, it's not necessarily error proof either. And so, you know, I think the way that I sort of would suggest getting started is this idea, back to the once a month sort of regularly review your finances. And, you know, the cadence doesn't matter. I mean, in some ways you could do it daily or what have you, but just picking a month is sort of an interval that's not, you know, that, you know, not that uncommon of a time to think about things. And then for that monthly snapshot, you can sort of look like, how much money came in and how much came out, and of the money that came out, you know, is any of that meant to drive, you know, future revenues, and just sort of feeling, you know, seeing, you know, how that's changing from month to month, I think is probably the best way to start that. And the reason I say that is because you know, ROI is tough, even for businesses that have dedicated teams. Like even, you know, where I work at FreshBooks, we have dedicated teams that do all kind of financial planning and analysis and such. And even then it's hard sometimes to say, well, what did we really get on our return on that? And that's because, you know, sometimes it's just hard to track, right? Like, you know, if you went and spoke somewhere, which is a great way of building your brand, is go and speak at a conference or event or something like that. It's going to be hard to then say specifically, oh, that person in the audience that heard me speak there, that became, you know, that mentioned it to someone else who became my client, you know, did I get ROI on that? You know, that kind of thing is really hard to do. So, you know, it may sound like, you know, I'm kind of dodging a little bit, but my point would be more of just, I would look to see, as I'm investing money in anything that I would bucket as growing the business, am I actually seeing returns of that, you know, a month or two later? And if yes, then okay, let's do more of that. If no, then maybe I got to change my mix of the kind of things I'm putting in that bucket of, you know, investments and growth.
Yeah.
Sticking with kind of that budgeting mindset, when you split between personal and professional expenses, do you recommend budgeting for both, or do you just kind of budget for your business?
It's a great question. I mean, what I spend 95% of the time, you know, thinking about is just budgeting for the business.
Okay.
And then the personal stuff is sort of set aside. Now, you know, I have no problem with people doing, you know, personal planning, for their year. I just, you know, anyway, I just don't necessarily go down that route. So what I often think of with a budget, and by the way, a budget's another one of these words that I think is just a loaded term. You know, I feel like, you know, 90% of the people that you ask them, what do you think about a budget? They're going to have a negative response. It's just this idea of like, you know, what is that word? And it's just, you know, it can mean, again, back to this concept of it can mean everything and nothing. But, you know, for me, a budget is really just setting your expectations. It's not only in how much you're going to make, but it's also in what you're going to spend. And I focus on that from a business standpoint. And so a great idea of a budget, as I was mentioning before, is reviewing your finances to say, like, you know, look back on the month and, you know, how much came in, how much went out. One thing that's really healthy is to then compare it to what did I think was going to happen? And whatever you thought was going to happen, that in a way is just your budget. That's how much you thought you were going to earn, and that's how much you thought you were going to spend. And that's a really enlightening way to manage your business, because once you set those expectations, then you can feel really good when you know that you're outperforming your budget in terms of, you know, more clients or more revenue or what have you. But it also gives you some guide rails to know, okay, maybe I'm actually spending more than I thought I would. And then, you know, you can either do that purposely and now you know that you have a reason to do it, or you can pull back and say, you know what, this gets me away from the plan I set out to, you know, start my year, start my month. And so, I think that the business budget in particular is really healthy, and it can also set this expectation for how much money at the end of the day is going to be yours to take home. And then you can track, you know, your progress against that too. And those, at a simplistic level, I don't think you need a lot of financial training to set those kinds of expectations. And that's why I think it's a great habit to get started with.
Are you looking at, I think one of the hardest parts, and I mentioned earlier in the intro about how the majority of creatives or freelancers are creatives. And my gut feeling, and Robert could probably attest to this, is that most creatives just don't want to put any effort into the business side of their craft. and so when it comes down to reviewing budgets and even doing, let's say, cash flow reports, profit losses, like, how do you reconcile that? Like, what is something that you think is super easy and transferable for somebody that just absolutely loathes and dreads this side of the business?
Well, I think that, by the way, I love the question, because it's sort of one of those age old questions. You know, and certainly creatives, as you mentioned, but lots of, you know, folks run their business because that's the business they want to run. They don't want to spend all their time being the, you know, the financial overseer of the business. And frankly, you know, our whole existence at FreshBooks is just to help people get over that hurdle. We try to do as much as we can for them, or save them time so they can do less of it. And just look, you know, get paid faster so they're not chasing all these things. And so we spend a bunch of time certainly thinking about how to just make things, you know, easier for folks in that space. Because a lot of people, they just have a notebook. And in that notebook is where they're like, you know, keeping, well, which projects am I working on? And who should I bill, or who should I send an invoice to? And who have I already sent? You know, it's just tracking all that in your head or in the notebook, you know, is just, you know, there's certainly automated ways with software that a lot of that stuff can happen today. So certainly I think there's software that's just going to help people, you know, level up their game. The other thing, I guess, that comes to mind when I think about the group there is, you know, one way of thinking about it is your bank account. And I mentioned that once before, but when I talk to people, whether they're using, you know, our software or any other software, or just not using software at all, one of the ways that people sort of think about how they're doing is, what's their bank balance? Mm-hmm. And that in a way, you know, it there's nothing, you know, inherently that's, you know, you shouldn't look at your bank balance. I mean, that's very important. At the end of the day, if you don't have the money in the bank, right, like, then you can't pay your contractor, or you can't get started on something until you get some money in. So that's not a bad thing, but it's just always so misleading. And that's the part that I think is the real opportunity, is to get something that's more representative than just your bank balance. Because in that bank balance, as we talked before, you might have personal things in there. Especially if you're just using one account for everything. So then all of a sudden it's right. Like you see some number, but what does it really mean? And even if you have your own one, you might see the bank balance, but that doesn't give you the true representation of, maybe you did invest in some stuff for growth, or maybe you're going to get paid tomorrow and you don't know it. So it's really not that good of a, you know, an indicator of how your business is doing. So I just look for some way that's something better than that sort of single entry or single ledger bank balance. And, you know, one way is getting some type of accounting software. Another one is finding someone who can be an advisor to you. And so certainly that doesn't come for free. But there are other things that you can do besides just help asking that person for help financially. You can also help that person for help with, you know, do I have the right business structure for what I'm trying to do? A lot of people that I've spoken with have started to think about, you know, should I incorporate this business? And just because, you know, you may be one person, it doesn't mean that, you know, you wouldn't create some type of corporation, or maybe I move it from sole prop to a partnership. But, you know, there are experts out there that can help with that. And oftentimes those are similar types of folks that, you know, may be able to help with getting some more visibility into the business at times.
Yeah. And kind of hopping on this, you know, being a creative and working on the non-creative side of your business, is there any maybe a step in the right direction that young entrepreneurs can take to maybe diversify their cash flow or income streams? You know, because I tend to think of myself as a photographer or videographer. Like that's maybe my one avenue that I'm attacking or marketing to sell my services. But that might, you know, like you said, be a lumpy type of thing where I have income coming in one month, next month is kind of dry. Is there any advice kind of looking for potential new or different revenue streams?
Yeah, well, I like this idea because certainly, you know, diversifying revenue streams is a path towards getting some more consistency, right? Because, you know, kind of they'll kind of make up for each other. If one has a down month, you got the other one there, sort of speak. So it kind of evens things out mm-hmm. a little bit. We did do some research and we found, I sort of went into the research thinking, you know, most people we're going to talk to, they've got four or five revenue streams just because it feels like there's so many different ways to freelance or to, you know, to have a side hustle or what have you. But the data actually showed that that wasn't really the case. It, you know, people generally had one or two. And so I sort of walked away with that with a couple different takeaways. One was, even if you just have one, and let's say, you know, it's the photography business, I think there are ways to reduce the lumpiness. And so that's one way of tackling it. An example there would be, you can do things like create some pricing packages that, you know, give more variety, or you have a package plan that, you know, somebody signs on for a few months or a few installments or milestones. It's just a way of, you know, or maybe the better way to describe this would be think of a concept like taking an upfront deposit. That's just one way to get some money in earlier in the process. Or if it's a big, you know, a big project, let's say it's going to take you 3 months. What can you do so that there's milestone billing as opposed to just waiting the full 3 months before you get this big chunk? So I think there are ways that you, when you think about, you know, how you package your services or how you price them, there are ways to reduce the lumpiness. And it's kind of no surprise that, you know, a lot of the tech companies out there move to this SaaS operating model where everybody pays a monthly fee based on some package. And in a way that's just smoothing out the income for them. So you could, you know, think about emulating some of that. So anyway, for what it's worth, I think there's a space where even if you're just on the one income stream, I think you can do some things to reduce the lumpiness of it. And then if you are interested in having the multiple streams, you know, I think in the, again back to the case of the photography, you know, one stream may be the service that you provide as a photography service, but then you also sell some of your work on a digital platform, and you know that becomes a second source of income. Or maybe you teach a class on the side, and that, you know, that becomes a third source. I think in some ways it's nice to have that. It's just, you know, it's just hard sometimes because now you're juggling, you know, so many other things. And certainly a lot of the literature out there is around finding passive sources of income, but you know that's easier said than done. You know, if it was so easy, everyone would buy an extra piece of property and just rent it out. But you know, but that takes maintenance and effort and everything else as well. So. I mean, again, it's hard to be black and white about these things. Certainly I think there is some benefit of having multiple streams, but at the same time, you don't want to spread yourself too thin. I'd rather have one that I could, you know, really double down on and build as opposed to three that were all kind of, you know, fledgling along. So, you know, it's a little bit of that too, and it just makes it hard, but certainly if they're complementary, you know, that's a great way to think about, reducing some of the risk.
So Matt, for those that have never thought about business structures, can you paint us a broader picture as to why incorporating could be beneficial?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of times you just get started as a sole proprietor. And some of the things we've talked to before is just the mixture of personal and business expenses. And so the easiest thing to do is just, you know, file taxes or consider yourself an extension of your personal identity, and you do that through a sole proprietorship. When you start thinking about other opportunities, I think it always comes with pros and cons. But certainly, I've seen a lot more folks getting access to and becoming incorporated. It does probably rely on finding an expert for, you know, that can really help you. A lot of accounting firms or small business accountants understand that side of it. And certainly, I just think of it in two ways. One is sort of, you know, risk mitigation, and the other one is sort of benefit. And so, in my mind, the reason to incorporate on the risk side is, you know, you can you know, sort of take away some of your personal liability with the business and create a separate entity. And you know, all major businesses in the world that are of scale are incorporated for the most part. And so there's definitely some reason why they do that, to protect themselves. And so I think
As you, you know, as you grow your business or as you scale, you know, there's no reason not to at least consider that. And so that's on the risk side. And then on the benefit side, it could be something like, you know, tax breaks or access, you know, to revenue growth in a way that, you know, it's a little different from a sole proprietor. And I think there are certainly experts. It's hard to give a blanket answer that would touch on all different verticals. But this idea of mitigating risk and, you know, exposing yourself to some benefits that you can't get is in my mind, the two things that you would explore and just try to understand if that is worth the effort, because it's going to take, you know, money to incorporate and it's going to take time. So you just want to make sure that you assess the opportunity and see if it fits.
Mm-hmm. So Matt, sticking with that, if a freelancer is coming to you and they ask you, like, when's the right time for me to incorporate, like, what would you, one, tell them? And then two, who would you advise them to? Like, who is that expert? What's their title?
Well, I think it's a fair question. And I'm certainly, you know, not, you know, a legal expert by any means. And, you know, it's hard sometimes to find the right common ground on advice like that. And so, you know, I would say that a lot of accounting firms and accounting professionals is the best place to start. These are the folks that might do your bookkeeping or might do your tax. And then they certainly help with what I would call advisory services. And a lot of that advice can be, you know, how to grow your business, what to think about if you're opening, you know, a new location or taking on employees. But the other part of that is business structure. And so I think that's the great, you know, first step to talk specifically to one of those advisors. And they may refer to you to, at the end of the day, a tax pro or something like that. And so it's for what it's worth, it is hard to find. But I would start there, certainly with a small business accountant. And the reason is, I mean, they just deal with so many other small businesses. If nothing else, they'll know why others have done it, you know, which is kind of, you know, the networking value of that piece. But I think that's probably the best bet. And then, you know, just that first part of your question is like, well, when to do that? You know, to me, it's almost like when you start having a proactive conversation with a professional like that is the right time to do it. So you may start, you know, a lot of people start, especially in that sole proprietorship that we talked about earlier, they start by doing their own taxes. They just kind of brute force their way through it. You know, maybe they're using some kind of online software or they're filling it out, but they just kind of figure it out on their own. And then they get to a point where they realize, hey, I need somebody to do this for me. It's like, it's taking me too much time, or I don't feel like I'm getting enough value out of the tax process. I'm going to lean on someone. And then usually that person, step one of that person is they're reactively just doing stuff for you. And then once you get a little bit more comfortable with them doing it for you, then usually that third step is you have a proactive conversation with them. Hey, what are some things I could be doing better? And that to me is exactly the right time to say, hey, do I have the right business structure? You know, what else could I do to maximize, you know, deductions and things like that? Because then you start to just, for what it's worth, yeah, just have that forward-looking, proactive conversation. And to me, you'll know when your business is starting to have that conversation. And that, anyway, that's exactly where I'd plug it in.
Do you see that, like, the younger generation sees risks of self-employment like different than maybe older generations do?
I really like the generation topic, and I've spent a lot of time trying to understand the perceptions of it. And I think that one of the biggest things I see is when I speak to people who are, let's call it, you know, over 50 and self-employed, most of them talk about if they've been doing it for their career, they talk about how when they were in their, you know, 30s, call it, there was a stigma of some sort attached to self-employment. It was like the person who couldn't get a real job ended up working for themselves in some way. And it was just, you know, it was just this feeling that it wasn't quite, you know, mainstream. And so I do think that that's very much one of the biggest changes. And, you know, I don't know how deep to go on that, but it's just back to this theme of a lot of the younger generation, I think, finds more value in controlling their career and having a lifestyle that they appreciate more so than working for, you know, a mega company or climbing the corporate ladder or having that sort of stability. And so if the American dream, so to speak, is shifting towards a little bit more of self-employment as an identity because you get to put yourself out there as your personal brand, then anyway, that shift to me just makes it so much more easier. And it's almost like when you're speaking with somebody that's, you know, the millennial generation is a good example. You know, it's almost like, oh, you don't have a side hustle? Why not? You know, which is, you know, that's the kind of perception that I find most interesting. Because again, just back based on those anecdotes, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it would have been like, oh man, you pick it up a second job, like you're having trouble with, you know, with the first one, right? So it's just, anyway, that has shifted so much in a really fascinating way. And so I just think, you know, self-employment is so much more accepted. And there's just so many other ways. There's so many tools to do it now too, which, you know, helps you get started. I don't know if it's any easier to actually succeed, but I think it's easier to get started.
I just started reading this book the other day called The Millionaire Next Door. And I'm assuming you may have read it or may know of it. And in it, and I know it's written in 1996, so it might be aged a little bit, but it said self-employed people make up less than 20% of the workers in America, but account for 2/3 of the millionaires. One, do you agree with that? And two, is that a motivating factor? I know it's hard to guarantee that just because you're self-employed that you're going to become a millionaire. It's almost never like that. But is that a motivating factor for people to gravitate towards that route?
Yes. I think that still holds true. What I would say is we find the biggest motivating factor is this idea of control. But a certain part of that subset of the control is controlling your income. And I think one thing that hasn't changed is the belief that, you know, if you really want to get to that upper echelon of income, you know, call yourself rich or whatever that means to you, you're going to see that happen more likely when you work for yourself, where you have this, you know, uncapped upside, as opposed to when you work for someone else. And generally speaking, you know, you're capped in a bunch of ways. So I do think there's absolutely a reality out there that when you work for yourself, you have the larger upside. On the 20%, that's a number I think maybe is changing a bit. I mean, some of the estimates are as high as, mm-hmm. you know, 50 million people in the US are doing, you know, some kind of freelance work. They might still have a day job, so to speak. But anyway, so I think that one might be changing a little bit. And then, yeah, I think, no surprise, I suppose, I guess when you look at the millionaires and billionaires, they're typically the head of the company, which in a way would be, you know, the business owner, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah. How would you coach somebody that maybe wants to move to that upper echelon that's maybe naturally defensive, and like we tend to save money to be more offensive in scaling their business and, you know, buying things that could help them progress their dreams forward?
Yeah. I like the phrasing there of defensive and offensive. I mean, certainly, you know, saving money is, you know, something that is underappreciated in the world today, or at least in, you know, in our society. Sometimes when you read so much about people being so far in debt, and it's just, it can be heartbreaking in some ways. So when you have somebody who's a saver, I certainly wouldn't want to, you know, try to convince them to do a 180 or anything of that nature. What I would do in that case is just talk about the opportunity cost of not investing. And so, you know, saving in and of itself is no problem. But if you have reason to believe you could put money towards, a venture of yours, and you are pretty reasonable that you can execute and get returns on it, then, you know, you're just limiting sort of the upside of your business if you don't do it. You know, and obviously you're always going to have execution risk or some other type of risk, but effectively, you know, I would, you know, somebody on that savings side, I would just try to rationalize on the return of the money versus, you know, sitting in a savings account or a checking account or an investment account versus if you put that money in the market, you know, and if you feel like you have a repeatable business model, you know, in some ways, then, you know, there's, opportunity to get a much higher return. And I think, you know, that can be pretty inspiring, but also, you know, help you get past the hurdle of, you know, just wanting to save.
I'll take the other side of that. Like, you know, how would you coach someone who purchases aggressively without regard to the profit and loss to start managing their expenses a little bit more defensively? Like, you know, how would you coach somebody that's on that end of the spectrum?
Yeah, you know what? It's almost in some ways, as you mentioned that, I was, kind of thinking, to myself as you mentioned it. It's almost in some ways I would approach it with a similar type of logic, which is, let's just go to the facts. And sometimes these things are hard to draw parallels to, but the nice thing about, you know, paper trails and accounting and all the rest is usually you can, you know, be at least directionally correct. So I think the best way with someone like that is to look through the past 6 months of the investments and try to understand, well, where are the, you know, the benefits from that? And, you know, generally speaking, if somebody's spending too much, it means that some of the things they're spending on are probably not the, you know, the strongest business case at the end of the day, if you phrase it that way. Or it doesn't have the strongest link to a benefit to the business. And so those are the kinds of things where you can start to then say, okay, well, let's bucket these expenses. You know, these were, you know, these were high return, these were middle, these were low, or you could bucket it by, you know, what specific, you know, benefit you got from it. But that's exactly what I would try to walk through and say, okay, well, you know, if you still believe this is a good investment, let's test it one more time. And then, you know, if you don't get anything out of it, hey, let's think about cutting that thing. And, you know, oftentimes those expenses I see that somebody's spending is maybe just like the set it and forget it type of thing. Like, oh, I'm just spending a lot in online advertising. And it's kind of on autopilot. Sometimes that doesn't return out as much, or maybe the, you know, doing some various types of travel. And, you know, if you're, you know, putting a lot of money into a conference, if that conference is not giving you leads, then, you know, it says, well, maybe it's not the right fit. Doesn't mean, hey, you shouldn't do conferences, but maybe we just got to find a different one. So to me, it's just, that, you know, that spending, you know, if you compare it to, the outcomes you get, that anyway, that's the best way, you know, that I try to rationalize it. For what it's worth, though, you know, sometimes there's always a underlying psychology for these things. So it's, you know, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to figure it out sometimes, but I try to just bring it back to the numbers as much as possible.
Right.
And think about, you know, understanding those better.
Yeah. Speaking of, we've kind of been on like saving and spending, how do you see successful small businesses engaging and managing with debt?
Okay. Yeah.
Do you think, you know, No, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, the debt, you know, it's a funny thing because back to what we were talking about before is like, there's good debt and bad debt. And then how do you know? And it's like, well, it's not always black and white again. And so I think that's just sometimes the struggle where there's not, you know, there's not a clear message out in the market. And so what I would generally say there is that, you know, for any business to grow at scale, it always takes on debt. So being just completely, you know, out on debt is not the answer. But it's just finding out which debt, you know, makes the most sense for you. And so, point being though, if you're paying a bunch of interest, that's not a good sign. If, mm-hmm. you know, your debt's increasing, that's generally not a good sign. And so those are kind of the things that I would look for, you know, and the way that I would say a ton of interest is if, like, you know, you're not paying down your credit card, you know, that generally is going to give you, a bunch of interest fees. Whereas if you went to a bank or an online lender, you could get a line of credit and you could borrow that kind of money at a much more, you know, a much more affordable price. Or if you, you know, have some type of credit or some type of debt facility and it's just growing, you know, that's kind of a bad sign. So I generally would say debt can be good if you're using it for something specific that you know, and you know sort of the payback, you know, periods on that and that you have a plan to pay it down. Anyway, so that's kind of the heuristic I would use. And then it's always interesting too to even just think about, well, what is the debt funding? You know, is it like some kind of actual physical thing, like a vehicle or an office or a warehouse, or is it the startup cost to take on a client? Or, you know, anyway, that all comes into play too. So that's why you know, I think I try to give as concise of a view as I can, but you know, it's back to this thing around all small businesses are quite different in a lot of ways. It's a very fragmented group. And so it's hard sometimes to be spot on with the generalities. But but anyway, for what it's worth, certainly I think the credit card debt's the one to really just try to avoid as much as possible.
Yeah. And this is kind of attacking on to that last answer that you gave. But, you know, like I find it interesting with students that like recent graduates, they interact with debt and they may not even realize it. Like usually the average student graduates with about $30,000 of student loan debt. And if they're breaking off into self-employment early, their startup costs, they need to get an automobile. How would you advise a young artist that's looking to break off on his or her own to interact and manage debt in a way that can, one, prevent the financial pitfalls, those catastrophes, but also encourage the growth?
Yeah, you know what? And by the way, I think the reason I like this topic is just, you know, it's not easy. You know, you just finished your degree. If you really want to start off and be your own boss, you know, I find that pretty inspiring. And so I certainly wouldn't want somebody to take a job just because they're like, hey, I got to pay off this debt. So I'm just going to go work for somebody else because it's super stable. I'm going to get paid every 2 weeks. They're going to take care of my benefits. Like, you know, I wouldn't want somebody to do that just because that's the easy way to manage debt. So certainly it's a worthwhile topic. And, you know, I've come to enough conversations with folks with student debt. I feel like in a lot of ways, the student debt, you don't necessarily have to be in a rush to pay it off. If it's a reasonable rate and it's spread out over, you know, several years, to me, that's one, you know, that you can kind of lock it in as an expense and then try to plan, you know, how you're going to, you know, take, how you're going to invest other money or income, so to speak. And so just kind of keep it on the side and pay it off. It's sort of similar in my mind to like a mortgage. You could always pay off a mortgage sooner if you fell into some money, but otherwise it's set up where, you know, you just kind of pay a certain amount every month, and hopefully it's not such a big chunk of your income that, you know, it's debilitating for the other things you want to do. And so one way would be to not rush to pay back the student debt, and then think about, okay, if I want to start this business, what do I really need? You know, and the car is a good example. Do I need a new car? Is this car going to be the face of my business where I'm showing up in front of the client every day? Because then, you know, then you got to actually think about, you know, how am I going to be perceived? But otherwise, you know, limiting those kind of expenses, you know, can be helpful. And then the other thing I would just say is, back to just this idea of planning out that business a little bit, is just thinking through, you know, maybe a 6-month window or a 12-month window. If I want to start off on my own, how many clients do I need? And, you know, in order to make some moderate amount of income that I want, you know, I just need to know how much I think a client's going to pay me, and then how many do I need to get in order to hit some, you know, some milestone. And then you can start to feel how reasonable that is to grow into this profile. You know, I just think, you know, sometimes just getting started is absolutely the way to go. But if you don't have a little bit of foresight, you can kind of make some of those decisions on debt that haunt you down the road, you know. And so if you can get a car for half the price of another, you know, maybe it's worth it given that you think it's going to take you time to scale your business. You know, anyways, it's those kind of conversations that I think are most helpful when it comes to the debt.
To kind of stretch the 6-month window to the other side of the spectrum, how about, you know, for small businesses, retirement plans, you know, thinking long-term, I don't want to work, you know, till I'm 100. It's a little bit complicated. Like there's 401ks, Roths, index funds. Do you have an idea of maybe those first steps? Is it important to just get the ball rolling, get started, or should you do a lot more research beforehand?
Yeah, another great topic in reality, because I mean, there's actually nothing worse than the only thing worse than planning for retirement would be like buying small business insurance or something. It's really hard out there to find the stuff that you know that matters. What I would say, what I know from the data that we do, is that the average self-employed person is saving less than the average employee. And usually that's due to the employees are making, you know, the programs available to, the employers are making programs available to their employees. They're making it easier to opt in, and therefore you just get a higher rate of people doing it. So I would definitely take the path that you mentioned around just get started. I think that that's the best way. And if you could get started in some kind of way that represents like a fixed, you know, or sort of like a recurring, almost like an annuity, if you can just commit to, you know, $50 a month, $100 a month, $500 a month, whatever works for your structure, if you can just commit to a consistent amount and just start putting that aside, I think that's the way to sort of try to put some consistency into your savings. Because if you think about it every month, it's like, well, maybe I need this money for something else. But if you just kind of commit to something, I think that's a great way to get started. And then the second thing I'll say, which is a lot of the plans that you mentioned, like the 401, you know, those can be complicated, and it can also be really costly to pull money out if you push money in. So one other way to think about this is just to put it into an investment account that, you know, that you can access, you know, more easily. And so just a typical, you know, investment account where you're investing in, you know, in something equivalent to the S&P or something like that. But just putting it in there means that you can pull it out with less limitations should you need it for a rainy day fund or something like that. And maybe that just gives people the peace of mind sometimes. I know that part of the struggle is you start putting it away, and then you feel like maybe you're going to need it sooner than retirement, right? And so I certainly, you know, wouldn't encourage anyone to pull it out unless they really had to. But if that's one of the things that's in the back of your mind, like, man, I need to have more of a safety net, then you could start doing the savings, but you could have it be a blended account that, you know, hopefully is retirement, but could also be the rainy day should you need it.
Yeah.
Matt, how much of a role does maximizing write-offs and deductions play into freelancing and small business owners? Like, and if so, what are some of the tactics that freelancers can start strategizing and utilizing today?
Well, this is certainly another area where I would say it's great to have someone that's an accounting professional that can help you and has seen how other businesses have succeeded in doing so. And so sometimes it's just getting the list of like, well, what are the real things that I can, you know, start deducting? And so, you know, oftentimes what comes up is things like a home office or travel or mileage or education. I mean, those are big buckets of things that usually you can write off. There's always some level of, you know, fine print, which is, you know, basically the whole tax code is, you know, is quite a lot of fine print there. But I'd say that's why you want to, you know, rely on somebody that has been to that rodeo before. And then those are absolutely some of the big buckets that everyone, you know, should start thinking about and taking care of. And, you know, what I would say is, you know, maybe if you're just getting started, sure, when you're just filing for the first time, you just want to have a successful filing. So, you know, maybe you're not, you know, overly strategizing. But as you start to have some of those proactive conversations, it's like, well, what else could I do? I mean, in some cases, you can even write off retirement contributions that we were just talking about. So, you know, that's another way to just reduce your income. And I think, you know, it's just worth mentioning again that, you know, the government expects you to deduct as much as you can. I mean, that's sort of, mm-hmm. it's sort of the expectation. And so if you're not doing it, you know, you're really just, you know, doing yourself a disservice. And,
right.
you know, and it's hard. It's just one of those additional hats that the business owner has to wear that in a lot of ways, you know, you don't have to do if you have this traditional job. But it's certainly, I think, worth relying on someone else, you know, making sure they explain it to you the best way possible. And then you could start to maximize some of those deductions. And it could be, yeah, some of those categories I mentioned, or it could be healthcare. It could be some piece of, you know, hardware, you know, some device that you need to buy, et cetera. Like, anyway, a lot of that stuff can be quite valid for deduction. So, it's good to start thinking about that early.
That's really good insight. I like that. And, you know, this is going to be like my kind of last question here before I send it over to Robert, but, we've talked a lot about the transition into self-employment and the mental and financial factors that need to be weighed. But for those who have already been self-employed for a while, like myself, I've been doing this for 3 or 4 years, but, for people that have been doing it and feel stuck in a rut, what's your biggest message to them to keep them motivated and, most importantly, on the right road to taking a bigger step in 2020 and beyond?
Okay. Great question. I think two things come to mind immediately as you sort of walk through that. Number one is, based on all of our research, what we find is satisfaction among people who work for themselves grows over time and is decidedly higher at the end of the career than someone who has a traditional job. And so what that says to me is that, you know, you're going to go through ruts and you're going to go through hard times, but if you build your own business and you find a way to make it sustainable, by the time your career is over, you're going to feel it was more worthwhile than generally working for someone else. And so the data bears that out. And so I would just give you that as, hey, there's light at the end of the tunnel. You know, if this is something you like and it's just, you know, a bit of a rut, you know, I would say, hey, let's, you know, figure out how to work through that. And, you know, because it seems to me that you're going to be happier in the long run if you find your way through it versus, you know, giving up on self-employment and working for someone else. So that would be kind of point one that I would say, to just try to keep the motivation there around doing it. And then point number two would be, you know, the thing that I sort of stress as much as I can is the ability to go out and prospect and find clients. To me, is the number one differentiator between businesses that make it long term and don't. And one of the heuristics out there, and again based on our data, is that a good amount of time to spend on finding new clients is around 20%. Which is, you know, equivalent to about a full day a week. And so, you know, thinking about spending a full day a week out there talking to new clients, or, you know, creating some proposals or drumming up new business, however you do that, is a great way to, you know, just those relationships will be what represent the future of your business. And so if you're trying to get out of a little bit of the status quo of delivering on some things that, you know, maybe you feel a little bit run down by, you know, getting outside of your business in a way to talk to people that, you know, could be future customers, I think is a great way to you know, re-energize.
Yeah. Matt, I just want to say thank you for your time. Is there any last comments or any last plugs for you, or some information where people could find info on FreshBooks?
Thanks. Thank you for asking. I would say freshbooks.com is the best resource. All the data that I mentioned is available there. We do an annual survey, plus we slice it in a bunch of different ways and give that out there. You can certainly also try our software if you want to just get paid faster. There's a free trial there. And then for me personally, at M. Bakerson on Twitter, always you know, looking to chat with folks that are self-employed.
Thank you so much, Matt, for the time. We really appreciate this. I think it's going to be a great way for our audience to kind of demystify some of the nuances of going into self-employment and seeing some tactical stuff about how to financially set themselves up. So we really do appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. So that's going to wrap it up for us today. If you guys have enjoyed the show, help us out by hitting that like or subscribe button on your favorite podcasting service. And if you're feeling extra generous, we'd really appreciate it if you left us a review. Don't forget to slide into our DMs on Instagram at Media1099Podcast with comments or topics you would like for us to cover. This is Robert Husky with Michael Durr signing off, and we will catch you on the next episode.